Well, in sequence, what do you do for a follow-up after darshan of the features of the Lord's form? The residents of Dwarka are having a festival, feasting their eyes on the form of the Lord, on his chest, which is the shelter of the goddess of fortune, his smiling face, which is like, what was it like? Drinking vessel. For what? For the eyes that want to see all beautiful things. The arms of the Lord. What were they compared to? Shelter for the demigods, because the demigods, they're administrating the affairs of the universe. And you know what happens when you become an administrator. Well, I can tell you what happens when you become an administrator. There's problems. And those persons need protection. No, it's a white sheet, not the yellow one. Not the yellow one, it's a white one. White. And then his lotus feet. What are his lotus feet compared to? The shelter of pure devotees. And what do pure devotees want? What are the pure devotees likened to? The mind of the pure devotee is likened to? A bee. And the lotus feet of the Lord is like honey, the bees like honey. The ants like honey too, but ants aren't as nice as bees. So what's next? What's next is Krishna enters into the palaces where the queens are situated. Now, what are the queens doing? What do queens do? They enjoy opulences, right? They're just busy enjoying the opulences of the king, having a grand time. But not the queens of Dwarka. The queens of Dwarka were surrounded by such opulences you can't imagine. But we're going to describe them even then. We can't imagine them because they're discussed in the Bhagavatam. Unbelievable opulences. But they're not interested in the opulences. They're interested in one thing. Krishna. They're completely absorbed in meditation upon Krishna. But it's fitting that he who is the source of all opulences is surrounded by opulences. So this is Krishna's displaying, or his display of opulences in Dwarka morning. Lord Krishna had 16,108 wives. And for each and every one of them, there was a fully equipped palace, complete with necessary compounds and gardens. Full description of these palaces is given in the 10th canto. So let's go to the 10th canto. And here the description. Here's a little, Prabhupada gives a little synopsis. All the palaces were made of the best marble stone. They were illuminated by jewels and decorated by curtains and carpets of velvet and silk, nicely bedecked and embroidered with gold lace. Well, here's a more complete description. This is Narada's visit to Dwarka. The circumstance of Narada visiting Dwarka was Krishna had just defeated Narakasura or Bhomasura, and along with that defeat, 16,000 queens. He just added to his entourage of queens, making it 16,108. And Narada thought, wow, 16,000. What's Krishna going to do to accommodate 16,000 queens? So he decided, I'll go visit Dwarka, pay a visit to my master and lord, Krishna, and see how he's faring with 16,000 wives. Thus the sage of the demigods eagerly went to Dwarka. The city was filled with sounds of birds and bees, not cars and trucks and motorcycles. Flying about the parks and pleasure gardens, while its lakes, crowded with blooming Indirvara, Amboja, Kalara, Kumada, and Utpala lotuses, different kinds of lotuses, resounded with the calls of swans and cranes. Dwarka boasted 900,000 royal palaces, not just 16. 900,000. How many people go to Agra to see one? 16,000? 900,000. All constructed with crystal and silver, splendorously decorated with huge emeralds. That's on the outside. Inside these palaces, the furnishings were bedecked with gold and jewels. Traffic moved along a well-laid-out system of boulevards, roads, intersections, and marketplaces, and many assembly houses and temples graced the charming city. The roads, courtyards, and commercial streets and residential patios were all sprinkled with water. And shaded from the sun's heat by banners waving from flagpoles. In the purport, it quotes Prabhupada from the Krishna book. The posts of the houses and palaces were bedecked with jewels, such as touchstone, sapphires, and emeralds. And the floors gave off a beautiful luster. All of this made Dwarka a glowing city. Big avenues, crossings, and lanes and streets, and also the thresholds of every residential house were very clean. On both sides of every path, there were tall trees, and at regular intervals there were trees that gave shade along the avenues so that the sunshine would not bother the passers-by. Then, in this city of Dwarka, was a private quarter worshipped by the planetary rulers. This district, where the demigod Vishvakarma had shown all his divine skill, was the residential area of Lord Hari, and thus it was gorgeously decorated by the 16,000 palaces of Lord Krishna's queens. So if you were to visit Dwarka, you would see all these, just like Gopakumar, when he visited Dwarka, he saw all these palaces, and they were so opulent, he thought, this surely must be the abode of my Lord. And he went to the palaces, and the people were, no, not this place. So when Narada got to the palaces of Krishna, oh, supporting the palace were coral pillars decoratively inlaid with Vaidurya gems. Sapphires bedecked the walls, and the floors glowed with perpetual brilliance. In that palace, Tushta had arranged canopies with hanging strands of pearls. What do we have today? Very different. There were also seats and beds fashioned of ivory and precious jewels. In attendance were many well-dressed maidservants bearing lockets on their necks, and also armor-clad guards with turbans, fine uniforms and jeweled earrings. The glow of the numerous jewel-studded lamps dispelled all darkness in the palace, my dear king. Shukadev is describing to Maharaj Parikshit, on the ornate ridges of the roof danced loudly crying peacocks who saw the fragrant aguru incense escaping through the holes of the lattice windows and mistook it for a cloud. So now he's going inside one of those palaces and he sees Krishna. In that palace, the learned Brahmana, Narada, saw the Lord of the Sattvatas, Sri Krishna, together with his wife who fanned him with a gold-handled yak-tail fan. She personally served him in this way, even though she was constantly attended by 1,000 maid-servants, equal to her in personal character, beauty, youth, and fine dress. That Supreme Lord is the greatest upholder of religious principles. Thus, when he noticed Narada, he at once rose from Goddess Sri's bed, bestowed with his crowned, bowed his crowned head at Narada's feet, and joined his palms, had the sage sit on his own seat, and so on. So, that's one place where there's description of just should start like, you know, instead of till the child gets out of control and then. So, Krishna is the all-opulent supreme and his abode is none different than him and his abode manifests all opulence. But we've just heard about one opulence. The opulence of wealth. But the Supreme Lord has 6 opulences in full. Who knows? Well, let's say what are the 6 opulences. Well, who knows the verse from Vishnu Purana spoken by Parashramuni? What's the verse? where Parashara Muni is describing the opulences of Bhagavan. Nobody knows the verse. What are the six opulences? And we'll start with Sanskrit. Anybody know them in Sanskrit? Viryasya, Yasasa, Shriya, Jnana, Vairagya. There's five. What are they? You're raising your hand? No. Do you know one of the opulences of Krishna? One of them is wealth, right? What's another one? Viryasya. You like fighting. You like the battle stories. Viryasya means strength, right? Yashasa. What's yasha? Someone who is yasha is famous. Famous. Everybody knows God. Some people say God's dead, but everybody knows him. So, strength, fame, shriya, beauty, jnana, knowledge, vairagya, renunciation. What's the one that's missing? Which one? What's he saying?
Wealth and strength.
Wealth and strength. Just in case you've got two of them. He has all opulences in full, and they're exhibited in Dwaraka. Therefore, it's described in the verse, he is sarvakamam, or the place is fulfilling all desires. But, you know, the root of all desires is to please Krishna. And because Krishna is the source of all opulence, he manifests naturally all that opulence in Dwaraka. Or as Prabhupada says, all desirable equipment was there for the happiness of Krishna and his entourage. Now the queens, that's the opulence of Dwaraka. Now come the queens of Dwaraka. And it's a 3-page purport. So Prabhupada wants to introduce us to the queens. The queens of Sri Krishna rejoiced within their minds to see their husband home after a long period abroad. The queens got up at once from their seats and meditations. Now they were meditating on Krishna because Krishna is absent. So they were just in the feeling of separation, thinking of only one thing, Krishna. And then lo and behold, Krishna came. So the meditation broke and they saw, just like Narada. His meditation broke and there was Krishna. Dhruva's meditation broke and there was the Supreme Lord. There's the Supreme Lord standing before them. Now they felt unlimited happiness. But at the same time, the expression of that happiness externally was checked by their shyness. Even before their husband. I'd like to read the whole purport. It's so wonderful. One of the points that Prabhupada makes is that as he entered, is describing one of the palaces, but there are 16,000 palaces. And so he entered into all 16,108 palaces at once. That means he expanded himself into 16,108 Krishnas, even if you could build a lot of palaces. Who could build palaces of that opulence? Nobody. 16,000 of them. Try, you know, a room with that kind of opulence. No way. He expanded himself into 16,108 Krishnas. So Prabhupada refers in the Shruti mantras, this is the meaning. In the beginning I was one and then became many. So the impersonalists have their idea. Their idea is, actually everything is one. Actually everything is one, it's all one. And this many thing is just, actually is just one thing. It's just Brahman. But here's the Vaishnava understanding. Krishna is one, but when he wants to expand himself into many, he can expand himself into many. Prabhupada writes, this is called Vaibhav, or the transcendental potency of the Lord. And it gets even more detailed and more detailed and more detailed and more detailed, just like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the postgraduate study where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was describing to Sanatana Goswami the tad ekatma rupa, you know, all those technical terms, where there's some expansions of the Lord where they're identical. One example of that is when Krishna entered his palaces. Or another example of that is when Krishna danced with the gopis at the rasa dance. They were identical forms of Krishna. Or another example of was when Krishna went to visit Shrutadeva. And King Bahulashva. So he manifested himself as two Krishnas. They were identical. But there's some expansions of Krishna where they're equal but not identical. Like Balaram. And there's some expansions of Krishna where they're not equal and not identical. But expansions of Krishna. Like the Vishnu Tattva forms, because the forms, according to the positions of the symbols of Vishnu, they have different names. So they're differently manifested, but they're not the same as Krishna. They're whatever it is, percent, 90-something percent. Not full. So they're called Kala. But we can also say Krishna. Like Vasudev Krishna, who appeared as the son of Vasudev and Devaki. But then he manifested his two-armed form instead of four-armed form. Like Krishna on the Kurukshetra battlefield, he manifested as the Irad Rup, then he manifested four-armed form, then he manifested his original form. And Krishna's statement to Arjuna, not anyone can see this two-armed form. Only those who are very qualified can see this two-armed form, qualified with pure devotion. And the queens were seeing that two-armed form. Then he speaks about people who hear 16,000 palaces, 16,000 queens, 16,000 different forms. They think of it in a mundane way. Either it's fancy or Krishna's lusty. But then Prabhupada makes the point, why just 16,000? 16 million is not enough. Because he's unlimited. And each of those queens, they're goddesses of fortune. They're expansions of his own plenary potency. Who can expand their wife? Nobody can do that. But Krishna can do that. And so if Krishna can expand a wife, why not 16 million? And palaces for each one, no problem. And then again, when it's time to go to the assembly, he merges into one Krishna and sits with the royal family, sits on the seat along with Ugrasena to rule over Dwarka. This is Krishna. unlimited and inexhaustible potency. Prabhupada concludes, God is great is eternal truth. But how great God is, that they do not know. So now the queens were following the codes of faithful and chaste wives, according to Yajnavalkya. There's statement here. He's given religious injunctions where a woman whose husband is away from home should not take part in any social functions, should not decorate her body, means not just simple cloth, not going into the public kind of decorate or attire, just very simple cloth, no decorations. Should not laugh, and should not go even to any relative's house in any circumstance, because there are social expectations in those situations. This is Yajnavalkya's statement. How that may apply or not apply in our modern circumstance is another thing. But the queens strictly observed this. They hadn't gone anywhere. But they were all the while fixed in the concentration upon Krishna, not because it was like a sadhana that they were doing. It was Krishna is their life and soul. They're goddesses of fortune, eternal associates of Krishna. Prabhupada writes, the Lord's devotees cannot live for a moment without meditating upon the Lord, and what to speak of the queens, who are all goddesses of fortune, incarnated as queens in the pastimes of the Lord at Dwarka. They can never be separated from the Lord, either by presence or by trance. So they were with the Lord in all circumstances, in other words. In the Leela is he's gone. So then Prabhupada speaks about the gopis, who are also attached to Krishna in that way. When Krishna would go into the forest, they couldn't stop thinking of Krishna. And they were thinking of Krishna's happiness. Oh, his poor feet, they're so soft. And there's thorns and stones in the forest, and Krishna's feet must be hurting. They were just thinking of Krishna in so many different ways. Now the queens, having been in that total trance of meditation upon Krishna, Krishna has entered into their palace and into their chamber. And now their emotions are just erupting with happiness. But there's a sequence. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, our blessed Acharya, describes the psychology of the queens and what transformed in their hearts. Who can understand the elevated status of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur? First, rising from their seats, although they wanted to see their husband, they were checked by feminine shyness. Next, the ecstasy was too strong. They overcame that stage of weakness due to shyness and became caught up with the idea of embracing the Lord. And this thought factually made them unconscious of their surrounding environment. This prime state of ecstasy annihilated all other formalities and social conventions, and thus they escaped all stumbling blocks in the path of meeting the Lord. And that is the perfect stage of meeting the Lord of the soul, Sri Krishna. That's the stage of ecstasy. So we're busy just trying to keep our mind on the holy name. we're far from ecstasy. Just, you know, sadhana and beating the mind and come on, mind. But hearing these descriptions, it's in the first canto of the Bhagavatam. Hearing these descriptions help us appreciate what awaits us if we just faithfully continue on the path of executing sadhana bhakti conscientiously. So now, yesterday we had a little discussion about chanting and going a little more deeply in chanting. Any of you tried that little exercise? Was it effective? Who was it that wanted to hear what the other two were? So would you like to share with us what your experience was this morning? I heard you. 1 month or so. What happened? We could turn this into a japa class, but I'll do, because I said I would do it, I'll share with you Bhaktivinoda Thakur's three stages of enhancing japa or going more deeply into chanting. They're very basic. It's not like something mystical or, oh, they didn't tell us this one. It's just he's categorized it. The first one, actually, there's three. They're in sequence. The first one is that become aware or meditate upon the spiritual characteristics of the holy name while chanting. For example, the holy name and Krishna are non-different. Simple. The form of Krishna's name is no less powerful than Krishna himself. Nijasarva Shaktis, right? So the exercise that we did with this one was, there's a few of them. While chanting, there was a meditation, like a calling unto Krishna. Krishna, you have manifested yourself on my tongue. Now please manifest yourself in my heart. And repeat. You have manifested yourself in my tongue. Please manifest yourself in my heart. Krishna is already in our heart, but it's inviting the non-different holy name to enter. And another exercise was chanting with your eyes closed. Picture the deity that you worship and the place, the room where the deity is. Here we are, the deity room. And with your eyes closed, so this is where we were, you know, not in the temple room, chant where you're before your deity in the temple room. And people actually felt very moved by that. In fact, one japa retreat, one devotee said he chanted 64 rounds like that. We were at a farm community in Canada. He had never been there before, and he has very nice deities at his home, Gornatai deities. He said the whole 64 rounds, he was just, his mind was absorbed in his deity, chanting the holy name before his deity. He was in ecstasy. So, the spiritual non-difference, the spiritual opulences, the spiritual potencies of the holy name. And then the next one was this exercise, meaning, and entering into the meaning of the mantra, which is, my Lord, please accept me, or I've turned my attention away from you. Please accept me. You know, you can fill it, just keep it simple so it doesn't get all complicated. I've turned my attention away from you. Please accept me. It's very much like what Rupa Goswami in that nice prayer that we read from the purport the other day. And the third is, combine these two, so the meaning of the mantra, the spiritual characteristics of the holy name, and then with heart-rending feeling, petition the Lord. Call out the holy name with feelings stirring within the heart, and with that one will experience mercy, reciprocation. I can elaborate on those things, but we spent, you know, like 45 minutes just covering those three things and doing them. So it's one thing just saying what they are. Then you can take these notes and, you know, tomorrow morning, the next morning, go through. The appeal was, I'm feeling separation from you, my Lord. There's a I Nanda Tanuja Kinkaram, that Shikshastakam verse, has the translation that Prabhupada gave, and there's others. Dravida has poeticized it, and Mahanidhi Swami wrote a very, very beautiful description of something like, you know, I know deep within my heart I have a intimate connection with you, but somehow I've turned away from you, and instead so many other distractions and contaminations are filling my consciousness and cluttering my mind, but still I know. So it's like this going beyond the stuff that we're always processing to the accessing that deeper feeling. And as Rupa Goswami's prayer was saying, I really don't have any taste for your devotion, so my prayer is that you allow me entrance into that, into your lotus feet. And that way I will get a taste. And it's true, this is this third item. With heart-rending feeling. It's not, certainly that can't be entered into in a mechanical way, but if steps of devotion and going more deeply, going more, approaching more conscientiously, the chanting of the holy name, just like the message of the Bhagavatam. The message of the Bhagavatam can be taken in a very superficial way. Lots of scholars do that. But Bhagavatam isn't about scholarship. Bhagavatam is about pure devotion and awakening in the hearts of the reader the natural attraction for Krishna that we have. Okay. He thinks he's a monkey. Okay. Any comments or questions? Yeah? I got about 50% of what you said. You were chanting this morning with the meaning, and then what happened? It was very effective. You're sharing. Good. So, anything in addition? Just that. Yeah, it's a duty. Just see the power of suggestion. And it's a mercy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur coming. We're dependent upon that. Thank you. That's it? More? You have a question. I didn't get the question. What's the question? Okay. Okay. So take your pick. Difficult choice? And it doesn't have to. It's in part anything that you're doing anew or in a beginning phase, it takes longer and after some time. So it's the concentration. It's not the adding something and therefore it takes more time. Okay? Anything else? Yes? That's when in the mature stage there's anishtita and nishtha. There's unsteady and steady. What's in between? anartha. So the eradication of anartha, anartha in the vritti, is necessary to come to nishtha. Does that answer your question? Now, how can we best relieve ourselves from anarthas? We're very weak. Our determination is very weak. And we're very weak. So if there's a benediction giving, a mercy giving personality who we can receive strength from, just like this example over here, Satyavrata's example, then something very wonderful happens, because it's a process of descending mercy. It's not a process of overcoming our anarthas. You follow? Were it not so, then we wouldn't need spiritual teachings, we wouldn't need spiritual teachers, we just have to be, you know, good karma yogis. But that's not our process. Our process is a bhakti process, it's descending. And there's a conduit through which that mercy descends. Those are the representatives of Krishna, the liverers of Krishna's mercy. Doesn't change the principle. Anything else? Yes? Well, I could barely hear him, so I'm sure you didn't hear him. His experience with this exercise was, it was very helpful in the beginning, but after some time, the mind again became cluttered. Yes? With business as usual kind of thoughts. Something like that, yeah? So how to stay there is your question. How to stay with that being connected. That's your question? Due to expectation from other services. So your mind is going to fulfilling different services instead of staying with the holy name. Well, one of the answers, of course, it's practice. Abhyasa, there's no substitute for that. But take the chanting as service, like we heard over here. You know, chanting is, you know, it's something that I do. But the idea of the service that we do is not, well, let's say, in an immature stage, it's not so much for whom are we doing this service and pleasing Krishna through the service. It's doing a service nicely and being recognized for being able to do a service nicely and having a sense of achievement. I did it nicely. It's just fruitive. I mean, Krishna is the object out there somewhere, but our attention is not on Krishna. Our attention is on doing our service nicely in a responsible way and so on. The bhakti is not yet aroused. Bhakti is upon Krishna. So, it's easier to do devotional service where we're doing something and we're accomplishing, something's getting done, our fruitive nature and our ego is being satisfied, our psychophysical nature. But what is there in chanting? It's just you and Krishna. So for people who are fruitive and minds are restless, it's very difficult to, so therefore chanting becomes a multi-processing time. Well, that's not an elevated stage of chanting. Or as one devotee was sharing at one japa retreat, japa had become a way to fix my day so I could do my service that day nicely. And there was a correlation. If I didn't do my chanting nicely, there was a great deal of trouble in my day. And if I did my chanting nicely, the day went nicely. So it was to fix my day so I could do my service nicely. And even while chanting, it was on doing my service nicely instead of on chanting. Because that's also a service. It's our most important service. Our relationship with Krishna. So that's why the mind wants to go there. Conditioned. We're conditioned by, you know, our original free will mistake of wanting to enjoy apart from Krishna. So that's that strong tendency continues even when we're chanting Krishna's name. Because, and once again, the thought of the service is not so much that Krishna should be pleased, it's so I can do my service in a responsible, conscientious way and be, you know, be a good devotee. Anything else? Yes? Are there things to prepare the mind before chanting the holy name, to fix the holy name while fix the mind on the holy name while chanting? That's your question? That's not your question. What's your question? Exercise is helping to focus the mind.
This is all the time meditation.
All the time meditation.
Only for chanting.
Oh. Why not all the time? So you change the frame from, okay, now we're chanting, now we're hearing the Bhagavatam, now we're honoring prasadam, now we're getting ready to go to the school, office, or workplace, whatever. You know, that they carry that contemplation. It's this, like this humble mood that Rupa Goswami was praying to Krishna. At the Lord's lotus feet, literally, at the Lord's lotus feet, praying that my be mind, be like mind, simply become captured in your lotus feet, even though I don't have the qualification, while I'm doing the service for you. And so on. So it applies in all circumstances. Okay. Time's up. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.